Iran slams European Union sanctions policy toward Tehran as unconstructive and ineffective, saying it does not benefit Europe. The Palestinian Prime Minister slams culture of impunity among Israeli forces, saying they kill Palestinians with no regard for international laws. And Pyongyang says an American soldier who has defected to North Korea intended to escape mistreatment and racial discrimination in the U.S. Army. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has slammed the European Union's sanctions policy toward the Islamic Republic, describing it as ineffective and unconstructive. In a phone call with the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell, the top Iranian diplomat called sanctions an unfriendly measure in Brussels-Tehran relations. Amir Abdollahian said continuation of this situation does not benefit Europe, adding Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency are on a right path of cooperation. Amir Abdollahian also touched upon Iran's policy regarding the Ukraine war, once again rejecting claims by Kiev and its Western allies that Iran is providing Russia with drones. Borrell, for his part, said that some misunderstandings between Iran and Europe can be resolved through dialogue. A senior Iranian military commander says the U.S.-led West hegemonic policies and excessive demands are to blame for devastating war in Ukraine. Deputy Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Brigadier General Aziz Nasirzadeh, made the remark at the 11th edition of the Moscow Conference on International Security. He added, scores of people are losing their lives every day in Ukraine, that is, due to the West's desire to maintain its hegemony. The Iranian commander also warned those who started the war and those who fuel its flames an unforeseeable reaction.
Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring oil on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian Defense Minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted, and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian Defense Minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones. Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Palestinian Prime Minister has come down hard on Israel after regime forces killed two young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Mohammad Shataya said Israeli terror machine does not stop committing crimes against Palestinians due to impunity enjoyed by perpetrators of such atrocities. He added that Israel continues to kill Palestinians without the slightest regard for international law. The two Palestinians, that is, were shot dead during an Israeli raid on a refugee camp near the city of Ariha, or Jericho, early Tuesday. Israel's intensified its violence across occupied territories as of late, killing more than 200 Palestinians since the start of the year. North Korea says an American soldier who crossed over into the north in July did so because of inhumane maltreatment and racial discrimination in the U.S. Army. North Korea State News Agency said that Travis King crossed into the north deliberately and illegally in order to stay there or seek refuge in a third country. Pyongyang said that King is disillusioned and at the unequal American society, adding U.S. soldier is currently under control of North Korean soldiers as an investigation continues. King dashed over into the north while on a civilian tour of the heavily fortified border between the two Koreas. U.S. officials say he was due to face disciplinary measures at home as he was facing allegations of assault in South Korea. Russia's former president says that if Ukraine agrees to cede some of its territory in return for joining NATO, it will have to give up its capital, Kiev. Dmitry Medvedev said that most of Ukraine's territory, even its capital, are historically parts of Russia. His remarks came after NATO's Secretary General, Chief of Staff, said that Ukraine may join the alliance in case of territorial concessions to Russia. Stian Jensen was referring to Ukrainian regions that have joined Russia through referenda, but are still claimed by Kiev as its own territory. A spokesperson for Ukraine's foreign ministry has rejected the suggestion, calling Jensen's proposal absolutely unacceptable. Now, the government of Canada's Northwest Territories has declared a state of emergency as the region is grappling with actual wildfires. A local official said declaration enables them to deploy necessary resources and protect residents. Wildfires have so far destroyed one remote community and threatened the territorial capital city of Yellowknife. Northwest Territories has seen 265 wildfires so far this year, much higher than its 10-year annual average of 185. Wildfires are raging on in all 13 Canadian provinces and territories, forcing home evacuations and disrupting energy production. Niger's military rulers say they're open to talks to find a solution for regional crisis caused by last month's coup to topple President Mohamed Bazoum. The announcement was made by Niger's junta-appointed prime minister following a meeting with a Chadian president. Ali Mahamane Lamine Ziyene said Niger is going through a transition process and wants to remain independent. His remarks came as West African army chiefs are set to discuss Niger's coup on Thursday and Friday. Meeting takes place after the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, threatened military intervention in Niger to reinstate the country's deposed president. On Tuesday, the Economic Community of Central African States also said it supports ECOWAS efforts to overturn the coup. A new report says the number of black minority ethnic workers in insecure jobs in the United Kingdom has more than doubled over the past decade. We discussed this issue with our guests earlier in our news review program.
It's time for this hour's news review. An umbrella union body has warned that the UK suffers from structural racism. It says the country's black and minority ethnic workers, low-paid and insecure jobs, have more than doubled in the past decade. Now, the Trades Union Congress says nearly 4 million Brits are in insecure employment positions. Out of those, over 800,000 were from black and minority ethnic backgrounds in 2022. That's up from 360,000 in 2011. Well, the union said that BME employment grew by 1.7 million people in the last decade, but 27% of the increase was in insecure work. BME men were almost twice as likely to be in insecure workplaces or work jobs as their white counterparts. Now, the term insecure work covers people on low pay, on variable hours, or doing seasonal or agency work. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of London, Amina Taylor. And out of Derby, UK, Chris Williamson, former British MP. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off with Amina. Amina, explain this a little bit more. What does it all really mean?
Well, I'm very pleased that the TUC is doing valuable research here. But I think for so many of us for whom this is lived experience, the data is simply backing up what we already know. For example, there, what the data doesn't break down is the fact that these institutional issues are not just based in the workforce. You end up having to do insecure, seasonal, 0 hours contract jobs because, first of all, it's government policy. I'm going to let Chris get all stuck into that. But if you are from a community that is over-policed, that is having some of the worst educational outcomes, as an example, I believe it's only white British working class Bangladeshi Asians who do worse in some educational outcomes than black Caribbeans. It must be noted that black Africans are actually a little bit higher up on this totem pole, just because of the way in which immigration has worked and the kind of emphasis that some of these families place on education, that so many of families from, for example, my Caribbean black background are realizing a little bit too late in the game that in order to have some way of getting out of this low 0 hours contract seasonal work situation, your grades have to be good. Your any kind of contact you've had with the criminal justice system will, of course, damage your ability to find a job that is a decent, high-paying one. Again, that feeds into what you're able to accomplish here. So there are other factors that are not just based on the employment. By the time you get to the employment, it's actually other factors that have been put into place here. We do remember many years ago my report where Lord Macpherson described the Metropolitan Police as being institutionally racist. You can't have these different factors feeding into a system mm-hmm. and then expect that especially black men will be able to reap the rewards from that. It has to be negative if the factors that are putting into that are negative.
Okay. Well, Chris, your take on why we're seeing an increase in this, I mean, compared to 10 years ago, it's just gotten increasingly worse. Why are we seeing that?
The first thing I'd say is to agree with Amina's contribution. It's undoubted, I think, that the black and minority ethnic communities are disproportionately affected by low-paid, insecure employment. But there's obviously a class dimension here. The working class have been screwed, frankly, over the last 40 years. And it's a direct consequence of the economic agenda that both the Labour and the Conservative governments have pursued, really, since 1979. Actually, it goes back a little bit before. Former Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, Six went to the international, was running out of money. That's, of course, impossible for a government own currency, as obviously we do in the United Kingdom, which obviously has the pound sterling as the national currency. And unfortunately, Thatcher then came into office, Margaret Thatcher, the Conservative leader at the time, and turbocharged the monetarist policies that were put into place by Dennis Healey, which were insisted upon by the International Monetary Fund. Ironically, that loan was never ever drawn down. It was never needed in the first place. And Dennis Healey, excuse me, subsequently acknowledged that the loan wasn't required. But then as I say, that paved the way for the Conservatives to come into office because there was a series of austerity measures put in place, massive cutbacks that led to a lot of disenchantment from the trade unions at the time and the so-called winter of discontent in 1979. Thatcher came in and, as I say, turbocharged that neoliberal agenda. Then fast forward 18 years to when Tony Blair came in as the Prime Minister leading the Labour Party, and he said his job was to build on Margaret Thatcher's achievements rather than to tear them down. And so the Labour government continued to pursue the neoliberal agenda. Now, that meant attacking the trade unions. It meant offshoring jobs to low-wage economies. Mm-hmm. It meant a predominance of, if you like, service sector employment and low status and low-value jobs sort of proliferated. And we're just continuing to see the consequences of that being played out today. And as I say, that is disproportionately black and minority ethnic communities, but it's not just black and minority ethnic communities that are being affected. Right. It's the working class across the piece that are being disproportionately discriminated against as a direct consequence of this misplaced economic agenda that's being pursued. There's a cross-party consensus on it now that, as I say, has been playing out now for the last 40 years. Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party offered some potential relief, but of course he was then destroyed by the vested interests and we never got that opportunity. Now we have a Labour Party led by Sir Keir Starmer, and it's very difficult to get a cigarette paper between the policy, economic policy agenda of the Tories and the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. So there's no real political alternative now, unfortunately, for the people of this country, and therefore very little relief looks to be on the horizon.
It just seems to be another reason that we're seeing so many countries right now, the neoliberal agenda that is actually falling apart around the world. Thanks so much for being with us here. Mina Taylor out of London and Chris Williamson, former British MP out of Derby, UK.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می‌کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we made you familiar with the views of British thinker Hamed Algar on Imam Khomeini. Algar, teacher of Islamic studies in Berkeley University of California, believes that the Islamic Revolution would have never triumphed without the leadership of Imam Khomeini. Today we are going to deal further with his views on the personality of Imam Khomeini. Stay tuned, please. British University professor Hamed Algar, in an article titled Imam Khomeini during the years before the revolution, points to the Imam's unique leadership not as an accidental and sudden phenomena, but the outcome of 15 years of incessant political and ideological endeavor, an organization of the entire nation in a single direction. He also points to the three important periods of the Imam's life as a whole with a single identity. Algar says Imam Khomeini had found a vision of Islam which encompassed all his spiritual, political, social, and ideological dimensions. The Imam had not even an iota of doubt in the course that he had chosen. The two outstanding aspects of Imam Khomeini's character were continuity of efforts and being uncompromising. Algar writes, the three periods of the Imam's life are the decades of formation of a spiritual and political character, the era of long struggle against the Pahlavi regime, and the years of the revolution and the Islamic Republic. From the very beginning, the Imam got a conspicuous vision of Islam, which contained its spiritual, ideological, social, and political dimensions. He remained on this vision for over half a century. Indeed, one of his prominent characteristics was the high scale of persistence, and being uncompromising was the only evident aspect of this persistence. The British thinker has tried in this article to pay attention to Imam Khomeini's training and upbringing through the years to set a ground to analyze the occurrence of the Islamic Revolution. Ahmed Algar maintains that Imam Khomeini's personality was mainly built up of firm belief in the personality of ulema in guiding and defending the Iranian society, belief in the necessity of strengthening spiritual aspects of Islam, hatred and rejection of the despotic Pahlavi regime, a strong resolve for cleansing the Islamic countries from the penetration of foreigners and distrust in secular intellectuals. Algar writes, the Imam studied the life of those ulema whom he had chosen as his role model. He had high skill as a teacher and a speaker. He stuck to an orderly and hard worship program and found a core of loyal followers who later on took control of most of the executive affairs. The British writer points to the childhood of Imam Khomeini and the high popularity of his father in the central city of Khomein, whose martyrdom by then regime was very sad for masses. He writes, it can be guessed how deeply and quickly Imam Khomeini was impacted by the news of their father's martyrdom. For sure, the naming of his son as Mustafa showed his love of keeping his father's name alive. Algar continues that the first time that the Imam witnessed the despotism of the Iranian regime was in childhood. He writes, Sayyid Murtaza, the Imam's elder brother, reminded to me in a conversation that Imam Khomeini had been a decisive person since his childhood. The martyrdom of their father and the death of their mother later on aggravated their concern, and thus these two brothers considered it as an obligation to guard their home in turn with rifle. The sense of regular struggle was further strengthened with the conditions of the family life. British researcher Hamed Algar continues, "No doubt, Imam Khomeini had a feeling of internal loyalty and fealty to ulema as the inheritors of the prophets and the imams, and as the guardians and narrators of religious instructions, which are essential to renew the prosperity of the Islamic society." Algar writes on the role of the Islamic wisdom and irfan, Gnosticism, in the formation of the imam's social and political character. It seems that purification of the view and will which exists in irfan, like political activity, has been at the service of Imam Khomeini as an internal revolution that has naturally created its external peer through the time. In the beginning of the Islamic Revolution in 1978, Imam Khomeini mentioned the factor of victory with extraordinary Gnostic vocabulary. He said that the people had put themselves at the presence of God and have attained divine entity. He described several times the martyrs of defense against the Iraqi assault as those who have achieved Allah's meeting. Dear listeners, on that note, we have to wrap up this episode. Next time, we will continue the discussion.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us contemplate on a beautiful statement from the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Certainly, these people have come to staunchly obey Satan and given up obeying the compassionate. They showed mischief, stopped acting in accordance with Islamic laws, took Muslims' property to themselves, made the haram designated by Allah halal, and turned his halal into haram.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. an introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, eating healthy in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service. In today's episode, we are talking about eating healthy in our Islamic lifestyle. So, dear friends, when we are talking about our Islamic lifestyle, one of the things that's really important is eating healthy. Now, there's a whole bunch of different, you know, fashions and fads and, you know, diet plans out there in order for us to be able to eat healthy. This eating healthy seems like it's a very secular and a very, you know, non-religiously affiliated concept. This is the farthest from the truth. When we look at all the divinely appointed messengers and prophets of the Almighty Allah, peace and blessings upon them all, they spoke about eating healthy. And if we just go to the most recent times, well over 1,000 years ago, before any of these healthy diet fads and, you know, kind of fashionable things came into being, we find that over 1,000 years ago, the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he spoke about eating healthy. And we find that the divinely appointed imams, alayhim as-salam, peace and blessings upon them all, they spoke about the importance of eating healthy in a Islamic lifestyle. Matter of fact, one of the things that they emphasized was eating healthy when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about Islamic lifestyle and we are talking about eating healthy. Now, we said in the previous segment that eating healthy is not something which came about and was some sort of innovation from the secular world or the Western world or the non-religiously affiliated world. Matter of fact, eating healthy is a divine command and it has been taught not only by Islam and the different messengers of the Almighty Allah, peace and blessings upon them, but also the divinely appointed imams. Matter of fact, we have a book by the name of Tibbur Ridha, which is apparently the different statements and traditions of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, the 8th divinely appointed imam, which specifically speaks about the medicinal aspects and what to eat, what not to eat, what to take for certain diseases, what not to do in order to cure certain diseases, and pretty much this eating healthy lifestyle. So if we want to truly live an Islamic lifestyle and we want to be able to expand our Islamic lifestyle, then one of the things that we are going to have to do is to eat healthy. Now, there's a lot of different factors and variables within this eating healthy, which inshallah we will speak about in other programs. But first and foremost, we have to give due credit to where it is due. Eating healthy and living a healthy lifestyle is a fundamental and primary aspect of a Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Thank you.
The History of Iranian Carpets,
Part 3.
It was almost from the middle of the 1980s that a large number of production units entered the market in this field, many of which are today one of the largest manufacturers of machine-made carpets in Iran. After the Islamic Revolution, one of the problems that Iranian carpets were faced with was currency issues and the US sanctions. Despite the sanctions and the presence of rival countries such as India, Pakistan, and China, it has become difficult to export Iranian carpets. Rival countries imitated the patterns of traditional Iranian carpets and offered carpets similar to Iranian carpets and sometimes even more delicate. Under the name of Iranian carpets, which foreign buyers couldn't identify, they're not Persian. The export of carpets in these countries is supported and the wages of the weavers are low. As a result, the carpets of these countries are often offered in the market at a low and uncompetitive price. From the beginning of the 1970s, the importance of carpet weaving in Iran's economy, particularly in terms of generating employment and providing foreign exchange income, was noticed. It was here that the first international exhibition of carpets of Iran was held in the permanent location of the exhibitions in 1992, and at the same time as the annual meeting of the International Conference on Carpet in Tehran, famous carpet experts and businessmen from 14 countries came to Iran, and this event raised the status of Iranian carpets in the world. After that, this international exhibition was held every year because it also boosted the domestic carpet market. As a result of this exhibition, a large number of carpet sellers turned to producing carpets, and gabe weaving, which was almost forgotten in the pre-revolution era, flourished again. Gabe is a traditional variety of carpets with the difference that it is usually prepared in smaller sizes and longer piles, and it is the handmade art of the nomads. After the second international carpet exhibition, in 1993, new woven samples of gabe came to the market, and for years they were exported more compared to other new woven carpets. Gabe weaving flourished so much that not only the nomads of Fars, Kogligluye, and Boya Ahmad, Shahar Mahal, and Bakhtiari, who were traditionally engaged in gabe weaving, but also many cities and villages in the south and center of Iran launched gabe weaving workshops. In addition to reviving the art of gabe weaving, which was almost being forgotten, rural and nomadic carpet weaving cooperatives and large dyeing centers were also established by Jihad of Construction and handicrafts organizations of Iran to improve the quality and quantity of carpet weaving in some parts of the country. But one of the most impressive innovations after the revolution was weaving large carpets by several hundred meters long by the initiative Iran Carpet Joint Stock Company. If we want to mention one of these masterpieces, we should visit the United Arab Emirates. This is the Sheikh Zayed Mosque in Abu Dhabi, the UAE. The Sheikh Zayed Mosque is the third grand mosque in the world, which also houses the world's largest carpet. The largest carpet in the world, which is spread in this mosque since 2010, is 5,634 square meters and is made by 1,200 carpet weavers living in Neishabur, who have woven it in two daily and night shifts for 18 months. This large carpet, which has been recorded as the world's largest carpet, in Guinness Book, was unveiled in a ceremony attended by local and foreign journalists in the Grand Mosella Mosque of Tehran. Every day, nearly 2,000 tourists visit the world's largest carpet in Sheikh Zayed Mosque. The design of this carpet is an overall flower covering 5 medallions in the middle of a green inner field. In the inner field of the carpet, embossed lines have been created that cannot be seen from a distance, but can be seen up close and guide the worshippers in creating straight and orderly processions. Another sample of hand-woven masterpieces after the revolution is spread in this location, Sultan Qaboos Grand Mosque in Oman. This carpet was woven in Naishabur for 3 years and was spread in this mosque in 2001. At the time, this carpet was considered the largest hand-woven carpet in the world. The approximate dimensions of this carpet are 60 by 70 meters, and it covers the entire surface of the main nave. The design of the central medallion of this carpet is inspired by the motifs of the Sheikh Lotfullah Mosque in Isfahan. Each of the oval motifs of this medallion gradually gets larger as it moves away from the center of the medallion and reflects a dome that is exactly under the dome of the Grand Mosque and creates a beautiful harmony with the interior architecture of the mosque. The inner field of the carpet is decorated with palmette flowers, and the weft is pure cotton yarn, and the pile is wool. This carpet now covers the main nave of Sultan Qaboos Grand Mosque in Muscat, Oman. With the establishment of Iran National Carpet Center at the beginning of 2003, the support of this national art and industry became targeted and focused. Therefore, despite the unfavorable economic situation, Iran's carpet maintained its global export position in the second to fourth ranks. Currently, 2 million people are directly engaged in carpet weaving and 191,000 people are working in its ancillary industries. Also, there are 115 conservatories in the field of carpets and 5,500 graduates of hand-woven carpet art. According to statistics, the largest export of Iranian carpets took place in 1994. This year, Iran was able to set a record of $2,117,000,000 in the export of hand-woven carpets, setting the best carpet export statistics for itself. In this year, nearly 44% of Iran's non-oil exports were supplied only through carpets, and around 5 to 7 million new jobs were created. Only 1 year later, i.e. in 1995, the amount of exports decreased from $2 billion to $1 billion, and in 1996, this number reached $675 million. In 2021, the exports of Iran's hand-woven carpets reached around $50 million. Among the reasons for the decline in the export of Iranian carpets are the sanctions, the presence of cheap carpets from China and India under the name of Iranian carpets, money transfer problems, lack of presence in international markets, and policies such as foreign exchange liabilities, neglecting delicate weaving and the quality of hand-woven carpets. In the foreign exchange liability, carpet traders are obliged to deliver the currency obtained from unsold carpet in the ways determined by the central bank. If the businessman cannot fulfill the foreign exchange obligation, their business card will be cancelled. This policy has caused many businessmen to cease the export of Iranian carpets and rugs. On the other hand, the increase in the cost of carpet weaving raw materials has also reduced the amount of production. Despite all these problems, Iran is usually among the three main carpet exporting countries in the world, and the Iranian carpets are still one of the most popular and high-quality ones in the global markets. Therefore, with a little support and attention, it can return to its main position. One of the solutions is to remove obstacles such as foreign exchange liabilities. Removing wrong policies and obstacles will definitely lead to more traders to export carpets. In addition to this, supporting organizations, given the importance of the production process, should also put supporting designers and weavers on their agenda. At the same time, experts need to prepare a targeted program for carpet production by examining the culture, demand, and taste of different countries. Countries like Latin America, China, and Russia have the largest markets for Iranian carpets. And among European countries, Germany, England, and Switzerland also use Iranian carpets. Arab countries like Lebanon, Kuwait, Qatar, and the UAE also demand Iranian carpets. If suitable markets for the export of hand-woven carpets and their needs are recognized, i.e. if the carpets are exported in a specialized manner and according to the tastes of the people of each country, Iranian carpets can compete in the best possible way in the country's markets. Another issue that has a great impact on exports is effective advertising. In order to export as many carpets as possible, it is necessary to be seen in international markets with professional advertisements. In this regard, the unique features of Iranian carpets that do not exist in Chinese, Indian, and Afghan carpets should be introduced to international buyers. Continued presence in public and virtual media, documenting and broadcasting on international networks, adds to the boom in sales and exports. The history of carpets in Iran is more than 2,500 years old. Iranian carpets have always been famous for their richness of color, variety of artistic patterns and design quality. So the Iranian carpets are kept in palaces, famous buildings, mansions and museums all over the world. Unfortunately, material intellectual property rights at the national and international level, i.e. copyright, is not implemented in our country, and this issue has led to the registration of Iranian designs in other countries by some profit seekers. Sometimes the designs and patterns of great Iranian designers in a different historical era are woven by weavers in China, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other countries and are sold at a low price in global markets under the name of Iranian carpets, hurting the credibility, authenticity, and national identity of Iranian carpets. Machine-made carpet factories have closed the path for innovation and creation of new designs based on the needs of today's customers of Iranian hand-woven carpet by abusing the absence of the material intellectual property rights and weaving the designs of authentic hand-woven carpet brands. With the recognition and implementation of the material intellectual property rights regarding the design, pattern, dyeing, weaving, method of carpets and other required items, the position of Iranian carpets at the international level will be improved. Our country relies on the export of carpets as a means of income. But with this historical background, the officials should just focus on supporting this art so that the Iranian carpet provides a large part of the country's non-oil income and helps develop this land by job creation, and to hand over this trust in the second flag of our dear Iran to the next generations.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Systematic abuse by Zionist settlers has displaced yet another Palestinian community. Dozens of families from the Qabun hamlets were forcibly transferred from their ancestral homes. They are not the first. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, "It was no simple task for Suleiman Nasr, a 44-year-old shepherd, to disassemble the tent that sheltered his family of seven. But he had no other choice. A cluster of Palestinian Bedouins, including Nasr's, had resided for 45 years in the Qabun hamlet east of Ramallah, within the heart of the occupied West Bank. Some of these families hailed from the lands of the Negev, which fell under Israeli regime control as the Negev in 1948. Today, they are once again compelled to abandon their ancestral lands, forced out due to an incessant onslaught of attacks by both Israeli regime army and the Zionist settlers." In an interview with Middle East Eye, Nasr expressed the unbearable nature of the settler attacks, which have grown increasingly relentless over the past 2 months. These assaults originate from the Shiloh settlement, strategically positioned between the cities of Ramallah and Nablus. Nasr described these attacks as systematic. He said, "Practically every day, our encampments and livestock are targeted. Stones are hurled in our direction, our children subjected to violence, and our women subjected to verbal abuse. These assailants wield batons and sharp implements against us, all of which attempting to steal our livestock. It was no simple task for Suleiman Nasr, a 44-year-old shepherd, to disassemble the tent that sheltered his family of seven, but he had no other choice." According to the Bedouins, who are landowning semi-nomad people, troops repeatedly intruded into their tents and makeshift homes, subjecting them to disturbance under the guise of inspections. The families were also subjected to physical assaults on multiple occasions. Around 300 Palestinians form the core of this community, living in tents and rudimentary structures fashioned from tin and mud. The Zionist regime's assertion that these are illegal constructions and the day-to-day actions of Israeli regime forces have led all Bedouin families in northeastern Ramallah to consolidate in a single location. Across the occupied West Bank, Bedouin communities share a common struggle against the Zionist regime's discriminatory policies. The majority find themselves located in the C-classified areas, falling under Israeli regime authority as stipulated by the Oslo Agreement. One such consolidated community resides in the Masafer Yatta region, to the south of Al-Khalil. Here, 20 interconnected groups are in a persistent battle against Israeli regime efforts to displace them, in order to enlarge the surrounding settlements and annex their lands. For Samer Hamade, 57, and his family, livestock is the only livelihood. However, their existence is marred by the relentless imposition of Israeli regime measures designed to coerce them into the surrendering their lands. However, their existence is marred by the relentless imposition of Israeli regime measures designed to coerce them into surrendering their lands. He said, "I was born here, and generations before me called this land home, long before the Israeli regime occupation emerged. Post-1967, life became a ceaseless struggle due to unending Israeli hostilities. We endure our days here, but it's hardly a life to speak of." Wafa News Agency, meanwhile, noted Israeli regime considers settlement as the core of its extended Zionist project. So, since the beginning of its establishment and occupation of the Palestinian territories, it used many colonial methods and tools to support and establish its Zionist project and to block the possibility of establishing a Palestinian state as well. According to the National Bureau for Boycott Affairs and Land Defense of the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, it said in a report that the Zionist movement and its institutions that were operating in the British Mandate Palestine are considered to be the root of terror in the region. The construction of military and paramilitary organizations, including terrorist Jewish organizations, was in full swing before the eyesight of the British Mandate government, and when the appropriate moment came, with the withdrawal of British forces from Palestine, the country was a scene for brutal attacks committed by trained and armed Jewish forces ready to implement what was later known as the Dalit Plan for a total ethnic cleansing, a plan that was approved by the leadership of the Zionist movement and the Jewish Agency in March 1948. Before assigning its implementation, it detailed directives to those forces, the report said. According to the report, the Dalit plan was based on ethnic cleansing as a central goal of its objectives. In a strict detailed directives, calling for merciless killing, spreading terror, besieging Palestinian cities and villages, burning homes and properties, and planting mines among the rubble to prevent the people from returning to their homes. As a result of that criminal plan, according to a number of new historians, in Israel, who reported